Intro. For the first time since August 2024, the month Ukraine launched its Kursk counteroffensive and seized over 1,000 square kilometers of Russian soil, Russia has recorded a net territorial loss in a single month. That is the finding of the Institute for the Study of War, covering April 2026. Not a slowdown, not a stalemate, a reversal. Ukraine outpaced Russian advances by 116 square kilometers in April alone. To put that in context, just 5 months earlier, in November 2025, Russia was seizing approximately 575 square kilometers in a single month. The momentum has not merely slowed, it has inverted. That structural shift in Ukraine is the starting point for today's briefing, but it is not the only front demanding attention. In the Strait of Hormuz, a full-spectrum confrontation between the United States and Iran is disrupting global energy transit, drawing China into a sanctions dispute that directly threatens a planned presidential summit. Inside Moscow's walls, security signals documented by the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project raise uncomfortable questions about Kremlin stability. And in the world of economic statecraft, analysts are documenting how sanctioning large economies produces parallel financial infrastructure rather than market exclusion, a finding with direct implications for every front we will examine today. Body. Let's start with the numbers from Ukraine because they tell a story that Russian official statements have actively tried to obscure. The Institute for the Study of War has been tracking territorial changes with granular precision. In March 2025, 1 year ago, Russian forces were capturing approximately 12.9 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory every single day. By March 2026, the ISW reported Russia achieved a net gain of only 23 square kilometers across all 31 days of that month. That is a reduction of more than 90% in the daily capture rate. And then came April 2026, when the trajectory tipped entirely. Ukraine outpaced Russian advances by 116 square kilometers, roughly 44 square miles. The Kyiv Post separately reported that Ukraine is now liberating territory at approximately 3.87 square kilometers per day, with nearly 50 square kilometers liberated in March alone, and an estimated 480 square kilometers recovered in February and late January combined. The Institute for the Study of War attributed Russia's deceleration to four compounding factors. First, Ukrainian ground counterattacks, which have become increasingly effective at exploiting weakened Russian lines. Second, Ukrainian mid-range drone strikes, operating at ranges of up to 200 kilometers behind Russian front lines, systematically dismantling logistics chains and air defense infrastructure. Third, the February 2026 block on Russian access to Starlink satellite terminals, a decision by SpaceX that produced, according to the outlet Militarny, a 75% drop in Starlink data traffic among Russian forces within days of its implementation. And fourth, the Kremlin's own restriction of Telegram, which had served as a critical real-time communication platform for Russian field units. Building on that, the ISW also noted an environmental factor that is easy to underestimate. The winter of 2025 to 2026 was colder and significantly wetter than the prior year, producing exceptionally muddy terrain that hampered Russian mechanized operations throughout March and April. Armored advances depend on ground hardness. When the ground turns to mud, the tanks stop moving. Casualty figures reinforce the attrition logic at the heart of Ukraine's strategy. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky reported that Russia sustained 35,351 casualties in March 2026, described as exceeding the previous record of approximately 35,000 recorded in December 2025. The figures did not improve for Moscow in April. Ukraine's Ministry of Defense reported 1,470 Russian casualties on April 29th alone, The UK Ministry of Defense reported that March marked the fourth consecutive month in which Russian battlefield losses exceeded new recruit intake. The Kyiv Post cited Russia's target of recruiting 409,000 contract soldiers by the end of 2026, but the current recruitment rate averages only 1,120 personnel per day, while the daily casualty rate runs between 1,000 and 1,200. The math is unforgiving. Ukrainian Defense Minister Mykhailo Fedorov has set a target of 50,000 Russian casualties per month by the end of 2026, a figure that, if achieved, would represent a further acceleration of already record-level attrition. Those figures stand in sharp contrast to what Russian officials have been saying publicly. On April 21st, Russian Chief of the General Staff Valery Gerasimov claimed Russian forces had taken 1,700 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory and 80 settlements during the broader spring offensive period, and 700 square kilometers and 34 settlements in the offensive's first 2 months. These figures directly contradict ISW data showing near zero Russian net gains in March and a net Russian loss in April. More striking still, according to commentary cited through the outlet War and Politics 24, it was Russian military bloggers, not Western analysts, who publicly disputed Gerasimov's village capture characterizations as exaggerations. When a government's own information ecosystem begins pushing back on official claims, the credibility gap has become difficult to manage. The technological dimension of this conflict deserves its own examination, because the weapons being deployed in 2026 bear little resemblance to what anyone anticipated at the start of the war. The Kyiv Post reported that 96% of Russian casualties are now being inflicted by drones. That is not a rounding error. It is a doctrinal revolution. Ukraine's general staff announced the destruction of 1,300 Russian ground robotics systems through early May. On May 1st, a Ukrainian drone strike on Russia's Shchigal airfield damaged four aircraft, including Su-57 and Su-34 fighters, some of Russia's most advanced frontline aircraft. The following day, May 2nd, Russian losses included 76 artillery systems, 282 vehicles and fuel tankers, 2,200 drones, and 12 ground robots, according to cited reporting. But perhaps the most strategically significant development is Ukraine's expanding deep strike capability. The FP-5 Flamingo, described as a drone-missile hybrid, carries a warhead weighing 1,100 kilograms, or approximately 2,400 pounds, at a stated range of up to 3,000 kilometers. According to reporting from the military show, the Flamingo has already been used against an Iskander missile production facility in Votkinsk. That is a strike against Russia's capacity to produce the very missiles it uses to bombard Ukrainian cities. Building on that, Ukraine's FP-9, a ballistic missile described as larger than Russia's own Iskander systems, has a range of 855 kilometers and an 800-kilogram warhead, and was nearing the end of its testing phase at the time of this reporting. Air raid alerts were reported in Kazan, approximately 2,000 kilometers from Ukraine, signaling that the operational reach of Ukrainian strikes has extended into regions that Russia's population had considered entirely safe from the conflict. Russia's economic position is deteriorating in parallel with its battlefield performance. Russia's GDP for the first quarter of 2026 fell 0.3% year-on-year, following stagnation throughout 2025. Ukraine has claimed Russia has lost approximately 12,000 tanks, 24,000 armored vehicles, and more than 41,000 artillery systems, equipment valued at approximately $142 billion in total, though the cited reporting does not independently verify those figures. Now to a set of signals that deserve careful attention, the Victory Day parade, or rather the absence of one. Russia's Victory Day, held every May 9th, is one of the most powerful pieces of political theater in the Kremlin's annual calendar. It projects military strength, historical legitimacy, and national unity simultaneously. This year, according to Reuters, it will be stripped to almost nothing. For the first time in approximately 18 years, since military equipment displays began in 2008 under Putin, no tanks, no armored vehicles, no artillery units, no air defense systems, and no intercontinental ballistic missiles will appear on the streets of Moscow. The only confirmed parade element is a flyover by a small number of fighter jets. The contrast with 2025 is jarring. Last year's parade featured approximately 150 military vehicles, including tanks, approximately 11,000 soldiers, and 27 world leaders, including Chinese President Xi Jinping. Russia's defense ministry attributed the absence to, quote, the current operational situation. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov stated Ukraine had launched full-scale terrorist activity. Abbas Galyamov, described as a former Putin speechwriter subsequently designated a foreign agent, publicly questioned whether the equipment absence reflected fear of a military mutiny or simply battlefield attrition that has left Russia without the hardware to display. Neither explanation is comfortable for Moscow. Both are being discussed openly. Building on that, on April 29, Russian presidential aide Yuri Ushakov announced Russia would implement a ceasefire on May 9, following a 1.5-hour telephone call between Putin and President Trump, during which Putin raised the issue of Ukrainian strikes on Russian territory. Kremlin spokesman Peskov confirmed on April 30 that the ceasefire was a unilateral Russian decision, with no corresponding signal from Kyiv. Zelensky responded that he did not want, in his words, any ceasefire to become a tactical deception by the Russian Federation. The internal security picture adds a layer of analysis that goes beyond the battlefield. The Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, citing an intelligence document attributed to an unidentified European Union member state, reported that the Kremlin has maintained a heightened internal security posture since March 2026. According to that report, Kremlin staff are barred from internet-capable phones and public transport. Surveillance cameras have been installed at the private residences of personnel in close proximity to Putin, including cooks, photographers, and bodyguards. And Putin himself has been residing primarily in Krasnodar, spending extended periods in refurbished underground bunkers. The OCCRP report also raises questions around Sergei Shoigu, the former defense minister and current Security Council member, in connection with a possible plot, noting the anomalous prior arrest of Shoigu's former top deputy. Personnel changes reinforce the pattern. Viktor Avzalov was removed as head of the Russian Air Force and replaced by Alexander Chiko, described as an army officer with a background in armored warfare, a move characterized in the transcript as loyalty-driven rather than merit-based. The director of a facility described as producing Sarmat missiles was also arrested, with Russia's intelligence service reportedly present at the site for approximately 2 weeks prior to the arrest. The official basis given was bribery. Chess Grandmaster Garry Kasparov was quoted noting that losing wars have historically preceded revolts in Russia, citing the 1905 Russo-Japanese War and the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan as precedents. It is worth noting that observation comes from a political opponent of the Russian government, not from an intelligence agency. But when former Kremlin speechwriters and chess grandmasters and European intelligence documents are all pointing in the same direction, the signal is worth registering. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights reported 15,578 Ukrainian civilians killed and 43,352 civilians injured in Russia's invasion through March 31. The Atlantic Council reported on March 24 that Russia bombed a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Lviv. In Crimea, Ukrainian operations targeting the peninsula's military infrastructure have intensified significantly. Ukraine's Special Operations Forces issued a telegram statement announcing that drones from SSO Middle Strike units struck a storage location for Iskander operational tactical missile systems on the night of April 28, targeting a concealed facility near the village of Ovrashki, 40 kilometers east of occupied Simferopol. The targeted bunkers, according to the report, are buried underground and protected by concrete up to 60 centimeters thick, with an additional soil layer above. These are not improvised storage sites. They are hardened military infrastructure designed to survive conventional attack. The New Voice of Ukraine reported Ukraine's likely weapon was the FP2 drone, produced by Firepoint, equipped with a 105-kilogram concrete-penetrating warhead, specifically designed for exactly this kind of fortified target. A variant with a 150-kilogram warhead is reportedly in development. Ukrinform noted that Iskander missiles cost Russia as much as $4 million per launch, meaning the destruction of even a handful of these systems carries significant strategic and economic weight. A follow-up strike on May 2nd struck a tactical group of Iskander systems and several radar installations on the occupied peninsula. Naval operations also continued. Ukraine's Navy issued a telegram statement on April 30th, reporting strikes on Russian vessels in the Kerch Strait area, identifying targets as the FSB patrol boat Sobol and the anti-sabotage boat Grishanok, describing in Ukrainian military language irreparable and sanitary losses. The cumulative strategic context for these strikes is significant. Over the first 2 years of the war, Ukraine destroyed or disabled approximately one-third of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, forcing Moscow to relocate warships from Sevastopol to Novorossiysk on the Russian mainland, a major operational retreat. By May 2024, according to the cited reporting, Russia had effectively ceased using the Kerch Bridge to supply frontline forces. The Sea Baby maritime drone, upgraded in October 2025 to a payload capacity of 2,000 kilograms, remains a persistent threat to Russian naval and logistical infrastructure throughout the Black Sea theater. Now to the Strait of Hormuz, where a separate but interconnected confrontation has been reshaping global energy markets and U.S.-Iran relations simultaneously. According to StratNews Global, recent days have seen drone and missile attacks targeting vessels transiting the waterway, with commercial ships damaged by projectiles or suspected mines, shipping traffic slowed, and global energy supplies under direct pressure. The United States launched an operation President Trump named Project Freedom, described by U.S. officials as a humanitarian escort effort to guide stranded commercial vessels safely through the strait. Trump warned that interference with those vessels, in his words, will, unfortunately, have to be dealt with forcefully. Iran's response was unambiguous. Tehran stated that any movement through the strait must be coordinated with Iranian forces, and warned that, quote, America's aggressive move to disrupt the current situation will result in nothing but further complicating the situation and endangering the security of vessels in this area. The situation escalated rapidly. According to StratNews Global, before one Monday had concluded, multiple merchant vessels in the Gulf reported explosions or fires. The U.S. announced it had destroyed six small Iranian military boats. An Iranian missile struck an oil port in the UAE that houses a major American military base, setting it on fire. Missile sirens were reported in parts of the UAE. Fox News, cited by the Rubin Report, reported that the UAE accused Iran of striking an empty oil tanker with two drones as it transited the strait. South Korea said it was working to verify that one of its vessels was also attacked by Iran. A post on Trump's Truth Social account announced that a military operation previously called Epic Fury had been renamed Project Freedom and would shift to an economic focus, noting seven small fast boats had been, in Trump's phrasing, shot down, with Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Dan Kane scheduled to hold a press conference the following morning. The economic stakes of this confrontation are immediately visible in American fuel prices. StratNews Global reported U.S. domestic fuel prices have reached an average of $4.45 per gallon, a figure that concentrates political attention on the conflict's domestic costs. The confrontation also has a China dimension that runs deeper than energy prices. The U.S. Treasury sanctioned Hengli Petrochemical in April, accusing it of purchasing billions of dollars in Iranian crude from the Revolutionary Guards Corps. Four additional Chinese independent refineries, including Shandong Jinshan and Hebi Xinchai, were also sanctioned. Per U.S. officials cited in the Strat News Global reporting, China purchases 90% of Iran's energy exports. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was direct, quote, "Let's see them step up with some diplomacy and get the Iranians to open the strait." Beijing's response was equally direct. China's Ministry of Commerce invoked a 2021 blocking measure, issuing a prohibiting order instructing the five affected refineries to, in the ministry's language, do not recognize, do not implement, and do not comply with the U.S. sanctions. China characterized the U.S. measures as a violation of international law. This dispute is directly entangled with a planned May 14th summit between President Trump and President Xi Jinping in Beijing, a meeting Trump described as important. The question of whether that summit proceeds, and in what atmosphere, may hinge in part on how the Strait of Hormuz situation develops in the days leading up to it. A U.S. legislator from South Carolina, speaking on the Iran situation in a transcript from the Jillian Michaels channel, stated the United States is currently in a ceasefire and negotiation phase, that no U.S. ground troops are on the ground, and that the situation is approaching the 60-day threshold relevant to the War Powers Resolution, the point at which congressional authorization becomes constitutionally required. The lawmaker cited Iran having enriched uranium to 60%, a figure stated without citation to an independent monitoring agency, and cited 14 U.S. personnel casualties in connection with the conflict, without breakdown or independent corroboration. The legislator warned that a ground operation related to Iranian oil transit could produce casualties in the range of 10,000 to 20,000 Marines, though no military planning document or agency assessment was cited to support that projection. The stated U.S. end state, as described by the lawmaker, would include a verified Iranian commitment not to develop nuclear weapons, an end to Iranian funding of proxy groups including Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis, and broader regional economic development. Whether diplomatic channels can produce that outcome before the war powers clock runs out is an open question. To understand why these confrontations, with Russia, with Iran, and with China, are proving so difficult to resolve through economic pressure, it helps to step back and examine how the tools of economic coercion actually work in 2026. An analytical framework provided by Rachel Ziemba, founder of Ziemba Insights, an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, in an episode of Shifting Ground, published by the Orbis Journal of World Affairs, offers some of the clearest thinking available on this question. Ziemba argued that applying sanctions to progressively larger economies, and she cited Russia specifically as a 10 million barrel per day oil producer, has had the practical effect of constructing parallel trade and financial infrastructure, rather than achieving market exclusion. The logic is counterintuitive but compelling. When you sanction a large enough economy, you force it and its trading partners to build workarounds. Those workarounds then become available to the next sanctioned economy, and the infrastructure becomes more robust with each iteration. She noted that Iran developed shadow fleet and evasive shipping infrastructure that was subsequently shared with Russia and significantly expanded after the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, with China's engagement in parallel networks serving as the central enabling factor. She also noted that U.S. and allied policymakers in 2022 and 2023 were constrained by genuine concern over the consequences of fully removing Russian oil from global markets, a constraint that shaped how aggressively sanctions were enforced in those critical early months. On the question of de-dollarization, the recurring claim that U.S. adversaries are abandoning the dollar as a global reserve currency, Ziemba offered a more measured assessment. She cited scholar Daniel McDowell's research as documenting marginal diversification away from dollar assets, characterizing this as additional friction rather than structural displacement. The dollar's dominance has not collapsed, but the friction is real, and it is accumulating. Ziemba referenced the academic framework of weaponized interdependence, a concept attributed to scholars Abe Newman and Henry Farrell, describing the U.S. Treasury's financial surveillance reach as producing a panopticon effect. The knowledge that transactions may be visible to U.S. authorities shapes behavior even when enforcement is not occurring. China has developed an alternative payment system called SIPS as a potential substitute for SWIFT, but Ziemba noted that early evidence indicated CIPs still relied on SWIFT for messaging, limiting its independence. She acknowledged, however, that more banks are now directly connected to SIPs, and point-to-point transactions may be becoming easier, a gradual erosion of the surveillance advantage. She separately flagged Tether, the offshore stablecoin platform, as an interesting edge case. It holds significant U.S. Treasury positions while operating outside direct U.S. Treasury jurisdiction, dollar-proximate assets that exist in a regulatory gray zone. On critical minerals, Ziemba identified a vulnerability that underlies nearly every strategic competition on the map today. The United States maintains a priority list of approximately 60 critical minerals, for a significant share of which China accounts for 85 to 90% or more of processing capacity. This is not just a U.S. problem. It shapes the strategic options of Japanese and Korean manufacturers who rely on Chinese-processed downstream supply chain inputs. She cited Japan's investment in a rare earth processing facility in Malaysia, developed with an Australian company following China's brief export restriction to Japan approximately 15 years ago, as an early model for supply chain diversification, a playbook that other countries are now trying to replicate at scale. The U.S. Development Finance Corporation has had its deployable capital ceiling raised to $210 billion, up from approximately $60 billion, with new authority to take equity stakes. But Ziemba characterized this as, in her words, still pretty small potatoes relative to Chinese Belt and Road Initiative capacity. On the broader trajectory of economic statecraft, Ziemba described a framing shift between administrations. The Biden administration approached critical mineral policy primarily through an energy transition lens. The focus was on clean energy supply chains. The current administration frames the same set of assets through a defense industrial base lens. The focus is on military readiness and strategic competition. The tools are largely the same. The stated purpose is different. Her bottom line, regardless of future administration changes, the broad toolkit of economic statecraft, industrial policy, development finance, and export controls is likely to persist. What shifts is the stated priorities and the choice of partners, not the underlying architecture. On the diplomatic front, a series of exchanges during the reporting period illuminated the state of transatlantic relations with unusual clarity. King Charles III's 2026 visit to the United States was characterized by the Warren Politics 24 source as unexpectedly productive. According to that source, Charles publicly stated in a speech to the U.S. Congress that Ukraine's security and sovereignty are vital, that the U.S.-UK relationship must be maintained, and that NATO unity is important, framing each point as implicitly directed at a Trump administration described as skeptical of those very positions. Charles also referenced the Magna Carta in a context interpreted as a caution against unlimited executive power. A lip-reading reconstruction of a private conversation between Trump and Charles, cited by a journalist from the New York Post and attributed to lip-reading expert Nicola Hickling, suggested Trump said Putin wants war and could wipe out populations. That reconstruction should be treated with appropriate caution. Lip-reading reconstructions of private conversations are not primary source evidence, but the reported exchange attracted significant attention. The Trump-Merz exchange was less subtle. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz publicly questioned whether the United States has an exit strategy for its military operation against Iran, making that remark in an address to students. President Trump's response on Truth Social was pointed. He wrote that Meares, quote, should spend more time on ending the war with Russia-Ukraine, where he has been totally ineffective, and fixing his broken country, especially immigration and energy, and less time on interfering with those that are getting rid of the Iran nuclear threat. The War and Politics 24 source noted that discussions of a potential U.S. troop withdrawal from Germany have recurred since 2017. Building on that friction, European leaders including Meares, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Finnish President Alexander Stubb have in recent days publicly called for European defense self-reliance, framing that call explicitly as a response to uncertainty about American commitments. Whether that call translates into actual defense spending and procurement decisions, or remains aspirational rhetoric, will be one of the defining institutional questions of 2026. One additional development from this period deserves attention, because it speaks to a longer-term shift in the geopolitical distribution of technological capability. On May 3, 2026, Mission Drishti, developed by the Bengaluru-based startup Galaxy, an IIT Madras-incubated company founded in 2021, was launched aboard a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. The satellite weighs approximately 190 kilograms and represents India's first privately developed Earth observation satellite and the largest satellite built by any Indian private company to date. Galaxy describes it as the world's first opto-SAR satellite, fusing optical imaging with synthetic aperture radar to enable imaging in day, night, and cloud cover conditions simultaneously, capabilities that matter enormously for both military and commercial users. Initial imagery delivery to customers is expected within weeks. The satellite is designed for dual-use applications across defense, agriculture, disaster management, maritime monitoring, and infrastructure planning, and is expected to complement ISRO's existing network of 29 Earth observation satellites. In a period defined by great power competition over technological advantage, the emergence of a robust private space sector in India, launching on American rockets, building world-first capabilities, is a data point worth tracking. Outro. So what does the picture look like when you step back and take it all in? In Ukraine, the structural momentum has shifted in a way that Russian official statements cannot conceal. Not when Russian military bloggers are contradicting their own generals, not when the Victory Day parade has been reduced to a flyover, and not when European intelligence documents are raising questions about the security posture inside the Kremlin itself. The war is not over. Russian forces still hold significant Ukrainian territory, but the attrition logic that Ukraine has been constructing through drones, deep strikes, economic pressure, and the patient degradation of Russian logistics appears, for the first time, to be producing measurable net results. In the Strait of Hormuz, the confrontation between the United States and Iran has crossed into direct military exchange, with the economic, diplomatic, and legal dimensions, fuel prices, China sanctions, the war powers clock, the Beijing summit, all compressing toward the same near-term decision points. And underneath both of these conflicts, the architecture of economic coercion is evolving in ways that make simple pressure campaigns harder to execute and easier to route around. Understanding that evolution is not academic, it is the operating environment for every diplomatic and military decision being made right now. Thank you for listening. That is your geopolitics briefing for today. We will be back tomorrow with the latest developments across all of these fronts. Stay with us.